right or not here, whether it's cross-cultural mission or Christ and Tanzania culture, it doesn't make a lot of difference, but whatever it is, we're at it. What we've done so far is we've talked about Christ. We've talked about Christ and the gospel for the world, and why we are talking about Christ and all cultures, rather than Moses or Muhammad or Peterson or somebody else and all cultures. We've discussed culture, what it is, and some characteristics of culture, and we were kind of on that when we cut off yesterday. And I'd like to continue that a little bit and then move into more specifically talking about Christ and the culture of Tanzania. When we talked about culture yesterday, after we had talked about what it is, we were giving some characteristics of culture that might help us in understanding more thoroughly how Christ relates to culture. And we had simply started with this one, and that is that all cultures are changing. They are not just static, they're not the same. I mentioned that many people have told us, well, in your missionary work in Africa, make sure that you don't change the Africa. When I tell this to my African friends, they say they're kind of insulting us, aren't they? Every other culture in the world changes. Why shouldn't we? There is probably no culture in the world that is completely isolated in and of itself. And even within an intact culture that's very strong, there are forces for change that are always at work. I mentioned yesterday that in the very traditional area where we worked the last 15 years, where I felt they were just about as much against change as anybody could be, yet change was coming, and it was coming partly through the transistor radio. The two main technological discoveries of the 20th century that have affected Africa are the bicycle and the transistor radio. The transistor radio brought the world into every little house. And whereas you used to see them walking down the road playing their finger guitars or finger pianos or whatever you call them, those little things they made, now they're carrying a transistor radio down the road and it's blaring things out. So it's changing.
Can I just interrupt there a second? We had a beautiful picture of a Navajo woman doing the weaving, just, it was, you know, braids and all. And on her wrist she was up was a Mickey Mouse watch.
Yeah. I was asked, I was studying in the University of Minnesota in 1957 in cultural anthropology, and I was asked by the professor to give an example of acculturation, the introduction of new ideas into culture. And I said, well, acculturation is when I look out the window of my home in Africa and I see a lady walking down the path carrying a Pepsi Cola bottle on top of her head. And he gave me a good mark for that one. The second thing I'd like to say about cultures that may help us in understanding them is that in every community there are conservatives and reformers. In every culture, in every community, there are people who will take different sides on different issues. And the danger in all indigenization programs or inculturation programs, if that's what you want to call them, the danger in all those programs is that we may, as a church, side too thoroughly with the reactionary and the backward looking. We may be so sure that we want to be like the traditional Africa that we've got no room for the African who has new ideas. And there are those that are there. Some Africans became Christian because they wanted some new ideas, not just because they wanted to reinforce the old. I remember it was in the about 10-15 years after independence in Tanzania, the government got all excited about the Maasai, the most traditional of all, because they wore the traditional rubega, which is just sort of a checkered cloth over them, the men, and it shows a good deal of the thigh and buttocks, and they thought this was disgraceful, the rest of the government, for some reason, the independent government. And also the Maasai lived in very primitive houses, in a sense, you know, almost like an igloo, but not made of snow. And so they had a drive on to make them make different houses, and they couldn't come into town with the rubega on and all that. And I remember at a church conference one time, I said that I can understand why the government might do something like this, but I didn't think the church should get too excited about this. Because let them change in their own way, in their own time. Don't put any pressure on them for change. If they want to wear the rubega, they'll wear it. If they want to live in those kind of houses, let them live that way. And a government officer who was also a Christian from Manduli was at the meeting, and he got very, very sharp with me. He said, you don't want them to change, you know. You want them to be the same all the time, see. So I was, as far as he was concerned, siding with the reactionary, and he wanted to get them going. Huh? Well, they did for a while. They tried, but you can't do things like that by law. It's impossible. I remember they passed a law saying that they couldn't come into town with their rubega. They had to wear pants. Huh? And my colleague went down to a kraal down below Old Anyasambu one time, and there in the middle of the kraal, there was a tree with a pair of trousers hanging on it. And he said, "What is this?" And he says, "Oh, that's a pair of trousers that anyone wears when they go to town." the whole clan just put them on. And so goes forced government change. However, of course, there's also a danger of allying oneself exclusively with the element for change, and then you no longer have the necessary rich infrastructure of society to support you. Some of the people here will know who I'm talking about probably. We had a man who came from California to the Meru people in Arusha, and he was to help establish a coffee co-op, and this he did, and a really good one. But in the process, he allied completely with that progressive element of the tribe. And that tribe has its forte has been to argue among themselves from way back. And in allying himself with the progressive element as he did, he had to really go home. There was no place for him because he didn't have any truck with the traditional part. But these are always there, the progressive and the traditionalist. Well, maybe the upshot of this is to say that though culture has many givens, they are not absolutes. They are not ultimates. Customs of behavior and value are the framework in which it is possible for human freedom to develop. For example, an understood language by which we communicate. Rules of law and order to hold off chaos. Traditions that guide us in our daily living, how we bury and marry and settle our disputes over land and everything. These are all very, very important. Without these given structures, we couldn't develop as humans. But they are not changeless. They are not absolute. Final authority belongs to Christ. In his cross and resurrection, Christ has established a place where we relate to God Almighty. This is the place from which we have the freedom to criticize, to challenge, to change the humanly developed cultures in which we live. In Christ, we are destined to sum up all things according to his purpose. I want to quote Newbegin in this book here, by the way. It's in the bookstore if anyone wants it. Foolishness to the Greeks by Newbegin. The cultures are elements in the created world which are subject to the rule of Christ, and the tensions in which they live are part of the tensions between the old creation and the new creation. Christ, who is the head of the church, is also the Lord of all cultures, and his purpose is that all share and shall that all shall be finally subject to him as the head. So it seems to me what we do is we seek the presence of the church in all cultures, not as an end in itself, but as a sign, a foretaste of God's purpose for all creation. And this is why we're all over the world. You know, when Jesus said, go and make disciples of all nations, the Greek for all nations was ta ethne. And it really doesn't mean a nation the way we think of nations today, like America and Germany and Japan and so forth, but it meant every people with its own language and culture. And those are the ones that we're called to go to. And in those cultures, in Tanzania, 120 of them in one nation. And here, how many cultures we have, subcultures and so forth, you'll have to all help me with that. Maybe the last day we can work on that some way. There's a dominant culture, but yet there are subcultures in our midst. But the gospel is to be meaningful within the forms that delineate our society in our day-to-day living. That's what it means to bring the gospel to all the world. We asked a question yesterday, which you didn't like, which you pondered in your subgroups, and that is, it was thrown in there on purpose, and that was, how true is culture? And you didn't like that one because it meant some discernment. I suppose most Christians would say that culture is ambivalent because people are ambivalent. We are created in the image of God with great potential and great possibilities, and at the same time we're part of fallen nature, and all we do is colored and tinged by this fallenness. And so culture is the same way. One of my favorites in reading about missiology is Kenneth Craig. And he wrote many books. He's a Britishman, but the one that you'll remember most if you read any of this is The Call of the Minaret. He's always been an expert in Islam. And in this he says, baptism, bringing persons within the church, means their incorporation by faith into the supranational fellowship of Christ. It does not deculturize the new believers. The new Christian becomes responsible to Christ for his old setting and to his old setting in the new truth, but he is not thereby going foreign. All that is not incompatible with Christ goes with him into baptism. Conversion is not migration. It is the personal discovery of the meaning of the universal Christ within the old framework of race, language, and tradition. Or Stephen Neal once said something like this anyway, that conversion is giving as much of myself as I understand to as much of God as I know, and obviously that's a lifetime process. And so that's going on all the time, whether as individuals and as groups. We've heard a lot in our generation about cultural revolutions, and I can't help but be impressed by how they mean different things in different places. Cultural revolution, as I understand it in China, and if someone knows more than I do about it, and I'm sure you do, you can tell me, but as I understand cultural revolution in China, it means really radically throwing off the old, Confucius included. When they were on this cultural revolution binge, they were just doing all they could to tear down the old traditions and to start new things in the name of the Red Guards and so forth. If I understand Africa rightly, cultural revolution means most of the time the opposite. It means rediscovering the wisdom of the ancestors, revaluing their ceremonies and renewing their languages. And sometimes this is done to impute an ancient authority to a modern program. For example, Tanzania has been blessed with the father of the nation, Julius Nyerere. And he has a concept called Ujamaa. If you come to our place in Idaho, you'll see a sign when you come in our territory and our land. It says Peterson Ujamaa Farm. And everyone says that they come, they say, Ujamaa must mean relaxation. Huh? No, it really doesn't. It means family. And or Jamaa means family, and Ujamaa means familyhood. Huh? And Nyerere took this concept of the extended clan and the family and the togetherness of this, and he said, now I want to apply it to the whole new nation. Now obviously it's kind of hard to do that, you know. What was possible for an extended family, it's pretty difficult to say we're going to make this now fit for a whole new nation out of 120 tribes, and many of the tribes having many extended families. You know, it's a great big thing. But nevertheless, I think you can call it the myth of Ujamaa has served them well. Huh? As they experiment with different social and economic programs, the myth of Ujamaa has served to hold them together. And they're trying out all these things. And one thing is the same in all this, and that is that Ujamaa means togetherness. And this is an emphasis of Tanzania socialism as well. Maybe what this about cultural revolution can tell us is that we need to observe and study and listen in order to sense the flow and the movement that is part of the situation that we're in any country, because we know that they are changing. Things are not always the same. Yesterday, when you gave me your characteristics of culture, you said that continuity is an important part of culture. That is, it's an accumulation from one generation to the next. This group that was over here, I think, I don't know how many of you are in it, but they came with this as their main contribution. This is true. It's also true that there is a rupture often with the continuity of the past. Adrian Hastings was I guess once you're in the Catholic Church, once you're a priest, you're always a priest, huh? He's now married.
Unless you get put out.
What?
Unless you get put out.
Yeah, well, they still call him a priest, but he can't perform the sacrament because he married somebody, and now he teaches in a university over there. But he was given time when he was in Tanzania. He was given time to go around and gather information and write, and he wrote a lot of really good stuff. Great person, and I spent some good hours with him. And he says regarding this matter of continuity that it's there even in the process of conversion. At the moment of conversion, one almost inevitably stresses the degree of rupture rather than the degree of continuity. That is, when a group is being converted to Christianity or an individual, in the beginning there's a rupture. There's a lot of difference. They want to get their identity. If they've got something new that's happened to them, inherent in the newness means holding off on some of the old. Huh? But then he says this can never be very thorough because you can't understand the new apart from the old. You don't even have a vocabulary for it. And so after a little while, continuity begins to stress itself again. Elaine and I saw this very much in the life of a young man called Philip. I remember when Philip came as a gangly teenager, maybe in Africa he was only in the seventh grade, but he was a teenager. And he came and said, I want an Injili, I want a gospel. And so we gave him the Gospel of Mark. And then later on he came back and said, in the Christianity classes in the schools, by the way, they're in release time by the government, and all the schools are Christianity classes. It could be Muslim classes as well, or Islam, but the Christians are the only ones to do it. In this, he came to said I to say that I love Jesus, huh? And I would like to be baptized. And his father was the most traditional of all in the area, and he had five or seven, I can't remember, four wives, and 30-some children. And none of them were in the Christian faith. So the elders went to the old man and they says, now Philip wants to be baptized, and we want you to know this means some new things in your extended clan. And he didn't say no and he didn't say yes. But anyway, Philip was baptized. And then later on, the old man put all the pressure he could on him to get him back. He chose a wife for him that Philip didn't want, a woman who had no education, no Christianity, was already pregnant and all that. And so Philip refused this with the help of the elders. When Philip finally did find someone, Imani, who was also sort of ostracized by her family to get married, then who is going to pay the bride wealth and all that sort of thing, you know? Philip's father wouldn't do it. He disowned him, put a curse on him. He said, you can't even come home. And so the elder said, we'll be your parent. And we will give they took 4,000 shillings of church offering money and bought a cow to give to Amani's father, the beginning of the bride wealth, so that the marriage be proper traditionally and the two clans be united and all that sort of thing. Well, in these days, during these days, Philip was very, very sure that everything of his past was wrong, that all the traditions of the Warush were wrong, and that his father didn't have an ounce of truth in him, and that, you know. And you can kind of blame him because his father was, you can kind of understand him because his father was pretty hard on him. But we've noticed now, as we've come back and when we lived there longer, that in a couple of years his father and him began to talk to one another again. And finally now the father has allowed him to have a garden in the homestead area, even though he isn't living there now. And the father, when the second child was born to Philip, the father brought a gift, which is traditional. And so Philip, even now, is beginning to see that not all of the past was wrong. Not all of the traditions were wrong. But to me, he's been a perfect example of what Adrian Hastings says is the rupture in the continuity. In the beginning, there's a real discontinuity. They don't want to be like it was. But then afterward they begin to appreciate there were things there that should be encouraged, that are a part of life. You know, when everyone reads scripture with the eyes of their experience. When Paul says that God is not far from any of us because in him we live and move and have our being. To me that means that every people all over the world had some things going for them. And that God was involved in this. They got to have a way to live. They got to have a pattern of society. This didn't all just happen by chance. Huh? And so Philip was able to look back on this and then begin to see that there are parts of this we want to keep. Huh? There are some of these things that are good. But often, you don't feel that way in the beginning. All this is simply to say that there is a necessary dialectic in the conversion process which can only be worked out as the years pass. Evidence of this was in the 1965 All African Theological Conference held at Makumira, where we taught at that time. And there were people from all over Africa, Africans, who were there. And I will never forget the argument that went on between two young men and two old men, Africans. On the one side was Thomas Musa from Central Synod, and Manas Buthelezi, who many of you probably have met in America. He's a bishop now in South Africa. They were about the same age, about 15, 20 years younger than I am, maybe here, I don't know. There was Bishop Moshi and Bishop Betungura, Moshi of the Lutheran Church in northern Tanzania and Betungura of the Anglican Church in Uganda. They were older men at that time. And these younger men were saying that what's wrong with polygamy? Why don't we accept it as just a normal way of life in the church, you know? Normal form of marriage. Then they were talking about all the glorious things that there were inherent in polygamy. Huh? And then these older men stood up and they said, well, how do you know that? Well, and then they said, what kind of a home were you born into? And both those young men said, we were born in Christian homes, where there was only one wife, one father. And then these older men, they talked about how, well, you know, we know a little more about this. Betungura said, my father had 3 wives, and the jealousy among them was so great that one of them poisoned, or two of them poisoned one of them, and killed her, and so forth. And then it went on and on and on. This is another example how you see somehow or another, these things are in flux. There are some that are progressive and some that are reactionary, and they have to work this out among themselves. Your comment this morning or yesterday morning or whatever it was about marriages, you know, and missionaries and polygamy, you know, it'll probably interest you to know that in our area, what the tack of the church there was to say that if someone has plural wives before they become Christians, everything comes in, huh? You just don't ask him to have any more, that's all, you know, but he keeps the pattern with which he... But these things are in flux, and they're not all going to agree. There are some going to be very adamantly against polygamy. Some of the Africans themselves, some of them will say, well, let's play with this a little bit, and let's see if it can't be one of the forms of marriage, and so forth. Hastings' writings remind me of Origen of Egypt. Origen of Egypt said that every people has its own Old Testament, its own traditions and religion. I don't think he meant by that they don't need the Old Testament of the Bible, because he translated the whole thing. He did mean that you got to pay attention to this Old Testament of their own tradition and religion and culture and society, which gives them the infrastructure that is necessary in society for them to live together in a certain degree of harmony without being thrown into complete chaos. In fact, Hastings goes pretty far here. You can disagree if you want to, but he says, what is now intended is to go farther in recognizing that current African Christianity has, in fact, and rightly so, 2 primary sources of inherited wisdom and continuity. Christian revelation and tradition on the one hand, and African conditional and African traditional religion on the other. Well, this then prepares us to go more deep into the study of cross-cultural missions, or Christ and mission and Tanzanian culture. We're ready to go into that at a deeper level now. Any comments, questions at this time that you'd like to that you'd like to talk about before we go on?
About the polygamy, were any women's opinions ever sought on this?
Oh, now they are. You know, in the last 20 years, women have an important part in the church. And we had a study in our Arusha Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Tanzania in which, out of 5, there were 2 women. Study.
What is their general opinion about polygamy?
Well, I think they don't want to see it as a normal form of Christian marriage. But hardly any of the men do either. The question is, how do you phase it out? Huh? That's the most difficult question. There are many forces other than Christianity that are sort of speaking against polygamy. Just the fact that the girls are educated with the boys, you know, and they get a lot of new and different ideas. So I don't look for, except in, say, very small break-off groups it could happen where polygamy becomes a norm. I don't expect it in the large traditional churches at all. There are women who are so reactionary that they are the greatest problems as far as change is concerned. For example, when it comes to overpopulation and childbirth and the introduction of Planned Parenthood and that, it's usually the women that give most of the trouble, because they have been taught from the beginning that this is what they're there for in life, you know, is to have children.
That's the uneducated.
What?
That's the uneducated.
Yeah, the uneducated one. Our sons were working for the Tanzania government out there, and they were in a program of village development, and they were in one area where they didn't have enough land left for their young people. And so they were trying to seek ways out whereby they could get a place for the young people. First thing they did was try to make better use of the soil they had. And then they sought areas out 15, 20 miles down in the plains. And there they ran into the Maasai, and the Maasai said, no, this is our area. And so David said, I was waiting for some of them to mention Planned Parenthood, but I wanted to wait till they mentioned it. It took them about 2 weeks. But finally one old man says, well, we're just having too many children, that's all. And David said, well, you know, your own government has its own Planned Parenthood office in town. And we know the lady that runs it, and we'll have her come out and talk to you. And in typical chauvinist fashion, they said, yeah, next Wednesday she comes out and talks to us men. And if we think it's okay, the next Wednesday she'll talk to the women. And so they came. And she came and talked to them and had a pretty good time with the men, she thought. Well, the next Wednesday, not one woman came. Not one. One of the men told David why. She said, she told her husband, if you don't get me pregnant, I'll find someone who will, because I know of no other reason to be alive. You know, she had just, she was really a traditionalist, not one educated, you know, but she had just been told that this is what we're here for, you know, and she couldn't think of life without this, at least with her at her age. So often they are the reactionary force. I know when the women ganged up 500 strong in Maasai land in Kibaya, their own African district commissioner wanted to introduce some changes such as these we're talking about regarding women and that. And they just said, no siree, you won't do anything like that around here. And they had a strong meeting. So this is a thing that takes time. Education, economic, stability and development, all this goes hand in hand, and then finally some of these ideas change along with it. But Elaine is, of course, right in that the younger educated women, they're thinking about differently.
In the conflict of cultures, we have been friends with a family, Dr. Sam Latagalwalki, a Maasai, who was a Lutheran pastor for a number of years there, trained there, and then he came to this country for further education, right. His doctorate in psychology and so on. And
we know him, by the way.
Pardon?
We know him well, by the way.
Okay. Yeah. Well, he has great respect for his father.
Yeah. So, yeah.
And he goes back every once in a while too. Uh-huh. But his children now here. His oldest son, in the culture of this country, his father still expected him to have the same kind of respect for him, total authority.
Yeah, that's right.
And this young man went through, because of the culture of our country, went through a great rebellion, which caused great heartache, and left home and so on like this, and had some real serious problems. But I'm thinking that conflict of cultures from his Maasai background to the freedom of our relationships and teenage relationships to parents here, there's a great, great struggle.
So it backfired, is what you're saying, because it was too abrupt. I've always said that change in Africa has to come slowly or it'll boomerang, sure as can be. They're much more traditional than we are, you know. And if it comes too quickly, like it had to come here because he was isolated from the background, you see, and that's the price he had to pay. Sam was one of my students at one time.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a fine person.
Thank you.
Any other questions, comments?
I was just wondering when the situation she brought up, the woman who, and you responded, this woman felt that her only option in life was, are there other options really available for people who don't have an education? What is there for them?
Yeah, it's good that you put who don't have an education, because first, before I answer your question, I'll say that those who do have an education now have real, as far as job opportunities, they have real equal opportunities. Tanzanian socialism is very succinct in that. Doesn't mean they always get it. You know how it is. Some things work. But like, for example, we had a bank manager in Arusha who was a woman and that sort of thing, and a district commissioner who was a woman, sort of like not a governor, but a township head or something like that. For the non-educated, I think these women that said that, and this woman that said that, had a very narrow interpretation of her own culture. Because truly, even though it's very stereotyped and delineated, they do have responsibility and privileges. But you don't jump over the traces, you know. And I think there are things that she could be well occupied with that would help her get over this idea that she had to have a child in the womb and another one on her back all of the time. But she hadn't come to that place where she felt that way yet. If you ask a Maasai that question, for example, a Maasai man, of course, they will say, by all means, we leave much of the ordinary things of the kraal and the extended clan to the women. For example, the milking and what you do with the milk, whether you sell or drink or whatever, that's all left up to the women. But I remind the men, the women can't sell the cows. And that's true, they can't, you know. So there are things where they feel they have a lot of freedom, but it's a pretty limited freedom. Huh? That's not as true in the many tribes that are not as nomadic as the Maasai. The nomadic are the most traditional. Huh? You know that from your experience too, I think. They're the ones that hang on the longest to things as they were. Any other comments? Thank you. All right, now I want to start talking about Tanzania culture. I want to read something first from Beryl Markham. She's a remnant, or she's dead now, but just a few years ago. She's a remnant of the colonial regime in Africa. She was a woman, became the first bush pilot in Kenya, was raised by a father in Kenya without a European mother, so he just left her to a couple African women, and she grew up truly like an African and really probably understood African ways more than most people of her time. And she's got a beautiful book, if you can get it in your library, West with the Night by Beryl Markham. Beautiful book. And in this she says, all nations lay claim to Africa. You know, she's not necessarily a committed Christian, I don't think. I don't know, but she really understands the Africa. Huh? All nations lay claim to Africa, but none has wholly possessed her yet. In time she will be taken, yielding neither to Nazi nor to fascist conquest, but to integrity equal to her own, and to wisdom capable of understanding her wisdom, and of discerning between wealth and fulfillment. Africa is less a wilderness than a repository of primary and fundamental values, and less a barbaric land than an unfamiliar voice. Barbarism, however bright its trappings, is still alien to her heart. I kind of identify with that. I like that. I know they've got real problems. I know in areas like South Africa, where they've been so honked up by so many things that have been so wrong, they're fighting one another like mad, and that I know that. Huh? But nevertheless, when you take it as a whole, there is a rich repository of value which is there to stay and is important for the human race. Huh? Many things that they have to offer. I was just reading in a paper out here this afternoon. One man was in an editorial or something. He had praised African nations for the fact that since independence, all these years from the 50s on down, they've kept the same boundaries.
Yeah, I saw that.
Huh?
I saw that in the paper. And I wondered if it's true.
Well, they have, but then today in the next paper there's an answer, and the person says, "Don't pat them on the back too much, because they also have shed quite a bit of blood in doing this." Huh? And they're sure, like Idi Amin in Uganda, for example, a lot of blood was shed there. But anyway, it is kind of true. You know, up until just a year or so ago, everyone would tell me, "Look at the Africans; all they can do is fight one another." And now I can say, look at the Europeans, all they can do is fight one another. I mean, they always thought that ethnicity was unique to the African cause. That's not true. If you look at these countries now what do you call that, mid-Europe or whatever it is, where the the ethnic conflicts are so great that much blood is being spilled. I want us to look now for the next, today and tomorrow, maybe even more, I want us to look at African culture in this way. Did I have a rag here, or did I knock it off when I... Oh, here it is. Yeah. My colleague in the Extension Seminary program was Pastor Gabriel Kimere, a friend of Sam Lotogalawakis, by the way. And both are Warush. And he and I, in our third year course, which would be called systematic theology or dogmatics here, we said we want to start with African religion, where they are, and then see how these relate to the fundamental faith, tenets of the faith that we have learned the first 2 years in biblical and historical theology. Well, when we decided to do this, we thought we would pick out some themes that we thought were quite common in all tribal religions. And this is what we arrived at, and we wrote lessons in Swahili for a year's study, which involved these five themes. At first, we called African religion a religion of relationships. Well, maybe I better write that one out. A religion of relationships. And the first theme we dealt with was creation. And the created world. Huh? Creation and all created things. The second theme we dealt with was sickness and health, as Africans understand it. And the third was people in community. And on this one, there's a whole ladder of rites of passage that we have to look at. And the fourth one was sacrifice and reconciliation. And the fifth one, we don't know sure if it should have been a whole theme or not, but it seemed so important we put it in. And that's simply the theme of curses and blessing. And we built a one-year course of self-instructional material off of these five themes. And we'd spend, say, maybe with each theme a couple weeks where we tried to look at this as positively as we could. And then we would look at it in the light of the Christian faith that had become part of our course the first 2 years. And then we would say, what does it mean to be a church with this kind of a background, with this kind of a cultural context? And we don't say that that's necessarily the best way or the only way, but it's one way, and someone has to start somewhere, huh? Because most of the time, Christian theology in Africa was taught by following the Ordo Salutis as we got it in the 16th century books. Huh? And we thought that there probably should be some other way whereby we could go at it. Well, what I want to do now is just say a little bit about the first one, creation in the created world. I had thought there'd be time for you to go into groups and evaluate it, but we can do that tomorrow if we have to. The first thing about what they had to say regarding creation is to know that they relied on stories. They had many stories. Sometimes each tribe well, your tribe always had its own story, sometimes even each extended clan. There are some truths that you only get at through story. That's why I was kind of excited last night when Witt was talking about Dan, what's his name? Yeah, this book, you know, where it's all looked at as a story. Stories convey truth, and they're important, but they look at them a little differently than we do. Because in America, the usual response is, but what I want to know, is the story true? We have established a relationship between truth and historicity, or truth and verifiable fact, that is very important for us in our culture. In fact, I think it's at this level that Christian fundamentalism is basically a form of rationalism, because they want to make sure that everything in the Bible fits verifiable fact. Well, they Africans have many stories. They got stories of the fall more than they have of creation, but they all kind of fit in together. The Wanyiramba even have a story of the fall that's very much like the biblical story. There was a tree in which there was a fruit, and the name of the fruit was the fruit that never gets ripe. And they were told not to eat of this fruit, and then, it's a long story, but someone ate of it, and then you got this disruption. The Maasai have a story that says, here is heaven, and here is earth, and they're close enough together so that there's a ladder whereby God can come down and men can go up, at least part way, and there's communication. There is not really disruption. Everything is going pretty good. In fact, sometimes you should have had a circle around the whole thing rather than just two things. And then along comes, it depends on where you are in Maasai land. If you're in some places, they say that the culprit was a hyena, which makes it sort of amoral. And a hyena came because this ladder was made of leather made from animal hides, and the rope leather kind of ladder. And the hyena got hungry and ate it, and God became off in the blue,
separated
from. And there was no longer this communication as there should have been. In some areas, it's the Maasai enemy, the Wandorobo, the other wilderness people who came and did it. But it's somebody else, it's not one of them. So heaven moved far from earth, and since then it's been difficult to communicate with God. But not impossible. It's not that the disruption is complete, but it's made very difficult. The Wafiomi have one which may interest you. If I can get this straight now, there was a polygamous household, and one of the wives was barren, and the other wife had many children, and the children didn't really mean to be discriminatory, probably, but they always loved their mother so much, and this other barren woman was so jealous that in the end she killed the other wife so that the children wouldn't give all their love to her. And then when the children buried their mother, they still gave her all her love because they kept on planting beautiful flowers and everything on the grave, and so she was still jealous. Well, and one of these plants came up and grew very tall, and this woman came out and hacked it off with her machete, and then blood spouted out of it and spouted up into the face of God and made him angry, and he moved away. So there the story involves jealousy because of polygamy. Very interesting in the light of what Africans usually say about things like this. But probably just the main thing to remember first is that they use stories. And stories are very significant for them. They don't ask, is it true? A story can be just as true if it's a parable, as though it were historical fact, as far as they are concerned. But though they fascinate me, I think more important is this, and I'll quote John Mbiti, one of their own theologians. "The invisible world presses hard on the visible. One speaks of the other. And African people see," in quotes, huh? "They see that invisible universe when they look at, hear, or feel the visible, tangible world. This is one of the most fundamental religious heritages of African people. The physical and spiritual are but two dimensions of the same universe. These dimensions dovetail into each other to the extent that at times and in places one is more real than, but not exclusive of the other." Well, whatever else you get about this, it's kind of holistic, isn't it? Huh? It's holistic in several ways. There are two ways in which I think it's holistic. And I think that word should be spelled W-H-O rather than H-O-L. But anyway, there are two ways in which their worldview is holistic. First, it's holistic in that the spiritual and that the material blend together in a unity that is given in creation. So you don't have the tendency to look at the material and the spiritual as antagonistic to one another, as we sometimes have in our tradition. I think that's overstated sometimes. We haven't always had them in antagonism, but there has been a lot of our tradition that has seen the spiritual and the material as sort of just always vying for the first place. It is also holistic in that knowing comes through more than reason for the African. Having a world like this in which the material and this, and in which the invisible and the visible are so much part of the same thing, Africans do not learn only through reason in their tradition. They learn in many ways. They learn through intuition, they learn through dreams, through visions. The world is bigger than that which you get through your head. I don't mean by that Africans don't use their head or that they denigrate the brain and the intellect, but they wouldn't say that that's the whole thing. Dreams become very important to them. Bengt Sundkler, that Swedish bishop, theologian of South Africa and later East Africa, says in his book that he wrote a book on it's called it. I can't remember the name, but he wrote a book on the ministry in Africa, and he said that 75% of the people he interviewed, African pastors, got their call in a dream. And we were talking a little bit about this morning with, what's his name? Tom, is it?
Tom.
Yeah, Tom Drogi. You know, like, if there's an openness to this part of the world, there's more communication when we live in a society in which this isn't expected and anticipated. One of the first times I met it was very early in my ministry when my co-pastor, Pastor Simeon Petro, his wife was very ill, and the doctor had said that if your wife is going to live, she cannot have any more children, so we must perform a tubal ligation, I believe it's called. And that was real. So the doctor said, "Here, this is your choice now. You have to come back in the morning and let us know if this is okay." And he came to me about it, and I was still just learning Swahili. It was real early, in 53 or something. And it was a very important thing to an African, to whom children mean everything. Even your assurance of good life after death depended on your children, and sort of things like that. But I remember I said, "You go home and think about it and pray about it." And he went home, and he came back in the morning, and I could tell right away by his countenance that he had an answer, because he had peace. And he related a dream to me. I cannot relate it to you. I didn't know Swahili well enough to understand more than about half of it at that time. But it was a dream with a lot of vegetation in it and flowers and plants. But anyway, it meant to him that, yes, my wife should have this operation. And it was a dream that settled it for him. I remember an extension seminary student by the name of Anea. We were talking about this one time in class, how people know get knowledge in different ways. And we mentioned dreams, and he raised his hand. He said, I have a dream that keeps coming back about 4 or 5 times a year, he said. It's a beautiful dream, and I want to know more about it. And so he told it to the class. He said, I'm in my bedroom, and they usually have wooden shutters for windows. And he says, the wooden shutters are open, and I'm laying down on my bed, and here comes this huge butterfly. Can barely get in the window shutters. And it comes and just hovers over me. Just hovers over me. And it's wonderful. He says, I wake up, and I have more peace and power and love than I had before. And it lasts a long time, he said. Now tell me about that dream, he said. And I says, I'm not a guru of dreams, but one thing I know in the Christian tradition and others even, but in the Christian tradition, the butterfly is a symbol of the resurrection. And that was enough for Inea. He says, ah, marvelous, he said. And he says, this comes back just when I needed this dream. And maybe he's still having this dream. I don't know. I haven't seen him for a long time. Anyway,
you may become Pharaoh of Egypt.
What?
You may become Pharaoh of Egypt.
Yeah, he may be. Maybe we can call him over and have a little help from him ourselves. Any comments on this so far that you want to talk about? Oh, we've come to the end, huh? Well, there's some things I want us to do about this a little bit, and then I want to talk about this first creation and created things and the interaction of the visible and invisible world, and then I want to ask you to break up and talk about how does that compare with your worldview, and with your view of creation and the people around you. Are our people in America different, whether they're highly educated or not highly educated regarding things like this and so forth? That's it for now then. Thank you very much.